The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And I'm here with my colleague, staff writer, Evan Osnos, who's been reporting for many years on Joe Biden. We've got a big piece coming out in the New Yorker this week, a profile of Biden. How are you doing, Evan?
I'm doing okay. Thanks, David.
Now, Evan, I've got a little trip down memory lane for you here from almost 4 years ago. You went to see Biden during the 2020 campaign. It was the height of the pandemic, and you were at his home in Delaware, masked and socially distant. And he spoke about his motivation to run against Donald Trump. Here's a bit from that interview.
Were Trump not running, I probably wouldn't be running. But it was, he's so contrary to everything that I believe about government. And that's sort of the antithesis of what I think we should be doing. We have always talked about, we've thought about, we've never lived up to, we the people hold these truths to be self-evident. Every kid learns them. I think most of us thought, even those with a lot of experience, thought that it's always going to be that way. We've never met it, but we constantly move closer and closer and closer to more inclusion. And all of a sudden, you're thinking to yourself, holy God, look at these guys. Look what's happening. Look what's being done. Look what's being said, not just by him, but by his followers and some of his elected colleagues.
Evan, that is approximately 4 years ago, and I wonder how you remember that interview, and what is the contrast between the Biden of 4 years ago, who was running for president, who would eventually unseat Donald Trump, and Joe Biden, the incumbent, whom you saw in the Oval Office just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, David, I have to say, hearing that kind of brings you back to that. When I went to see him this time, here he was at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. It was a slightly kind of overly formal occasion. The first thing he wanted to do was say, let me take you and show you, as he put it, where Trump watched the revolution. And I'm sitting there, and Biden has brought me in there, and I think to myself, okay, he's going to give me a little speech or something. Biden's famous for, shall we say, having a speech at the ready as needed. But in this case, he didn't do it. Actually, he just kind of gave this very angry, bitter laugh, and he walked back to the Oval Office where we did the interview. And it was the first sign for me of what I realized. This is a matter of great personal importance to Joe Biden. He feels almost viscerally this contempt for Trump and what Trump did to the country. And after all, let's remember what Trump did to Joe Biden. I mean, he didn't just try to steal this election from Biden's perspective. He tried to steal it from him.
How did he seem to you?
He seemed slower in his movements and his gestures. His voice is very kind of clotted. But he didn't do anything that made me think that his mind is any different than it was in 2020. But there is this contrast, this juxtaposition between how he looks and the things that he says that I think is in some ways what every voter is trying to navigate through and make sense of.
You know, Evan, years ago, Biden called himself a bridge president. And many of us took that to mean he might be a one-term president, that he'd finally step aside for another generation of leaders. But at some point, obviously, he decided to run again. Did you ask him about that decision?
Yeah, I asked him a question very specifically. Was there ever a moment in the course of this first term, of this term, when you said, I may not do this again? And he said no, right away. What he was saying, and he said it over and over again over the course of the time that I was talking to him, was, I've earned this. That's his message. I've earned the right to do this. And he said any other president in my situation would be running for re-election.
But no candidate has ever been in his situation. No candidate has ever been 81 years old running for re-election.
On some level, he goes right by that fact. And he says, no, this is about what I have done in the presidency, meaning in his mind, legislation, what I've done on the foreign affairs front, things like that. That is the core of what's going on here, David, is that this man has no doubts right now. I mean, we and the world are looking very hard and debating this question of should he be doing this? Joe Biden is not debating this question of whether he should be doing this.
In the tape we played, the message was, I think, and throughout the interview that you did in 2020, the interview was this: Trump is crazy and I'm going to restore sanity. I think that's fair. Has that message changed?
No. On some level, that is still not just the message, but it's also the strategy. They know that there are a lot of Democrats that might be popular presidential contenders. Joe Biden's view is they haven't earned the right to do this and they haven't shown the ability necessarily to win. And the way that they then imagine that they're going to beat what is this very evident set of obstacles and doubts that people have is that when the moment comes, when it's a choice between two, that they believe that they will, that Biden will win.
What would a debate between the two of them in 2024 look like?
Oof. I think, for one thing, I'm not sure that there is going to be a debate.
Do you think Joe Biden could get away with that? Don't you think that most people would think, he doesn't want to debate because he's going to look old?
Some people will say that, but they're already saying that. I think that's already part of it.
It's the Washington term. It's baked in.
But that's, that actually, David, though, that is a key piece of this whole process, which is how much is baked in. Because that is, from Joe Biden's perspective, one thing he said to me that really struck me was he said, you guys, meaning you, the press, he said, have become numb to all of that, all of Trump's threats of violence, of fundamentally undermining the nature of American democracy. This was one thing that really was noticeable, was there was an undertone of our conversation that was testy. He said over and over again that he thought that the press was not really engaging either his wins adequately or Trump's menace adequately.
Do you agree with him?
Look, I think the press is doing what the press does, which is that it presses hard on questions of significance. So his age is a legitimate and significant question here. I think there is a degree, though, to which the press has become kind of accepting of the idea that everything Trump does is just another level of endless extremity. And what does it really mean? How much can he get away with? There is a piece of that. I think the press is a part of this election in an awkward way that we're still trying to navigate.
How do you mean?
It's become assumed that Trump is in this commanding position now. I mean, the best example of this was that in the Davos conference, whatever it was, in January, that everybody was essentially assuming, according to the reporting from there, that Trump is on his way to winning. And that becomes baked in, to use your term, which is there becomes a sense of that this is an inevitability. And the truth is that it's noticeable that the Biden people and Biden himself, they're not panicking. Actually, around them, and this frankly gives Democrats a lot of concern, there is an almost ostentatious level of serenity, as if they say, they feel that a lot of the numbers and a lot of the commentary is wrong. I heard over and over again from Biden's advisors, and he's said versions of this himself, that he doesn't really believe that he's trailing in the polls as much as they suggest. And they say, because we think polls have been pretty bad for the last 10 years.
And they have. They have. But after a while, in their multiplicity, those polls begin to reflect a reality. And one of the realities is that in the state of Michigan, for example, in the primary, we just saw a significant number of people writing in a protest vote having to do with Biden's support of Israel. Now, we don't know if those people become Trump voters necessarily in the fall, but they're registering tremendous frustration with Biden in a state that is absolutely crucial to the election. You were talking with Arab American and Muslim voters in Michigan about Biden. How is that story developing?
Yeah, I was really struck by a conversation I had with a voter named Mohammed Kazaz, who I've talked to over the years. I mean, I met him in 2020 when he was a huge Biden fan. Hmm. And when I talked to him the other day, he is a Palestinian American, and the depth of his rage at Biden, at the Democratic Party, is profound. And he said to me, he's a very sophisticated political consumer and participant, and he said, look, the Democrats think that we're going to come back in the fall once it's a choice between these two. And he said, we're not coming back because, in his mind, it's better to stay home and to write in ceasefire now on your ballot than it is to support Joe Biden, even against the risk of a Trump presidency. It is also true, it's hard to make a case that that would improve the lives of Palestinians in Gaza and elsewhere more than a Biden presidency would. I mean, that's
the state of Michigan is also a place where Joe Biden went and did something I've never seen a president do, which is get on a picket line for the United Auto Workers.
Wall Street didn't build the country. The middle class built the country. Yeah. Unions built the middle class. Yeah. That's a fact. Yeah. So let's keep going. You deserve what you've earned, and you've earned a hell of a lot more than you're getting paid now. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's the balance that is being weighed here. Joe Biden has made an effort to try to say, I am actually still the person who is close to the labor movement, who is close to working men and women. And I know what you're saying. I get what you're saying about the war in Gaza, but this is, he doesn't use this term, but this is even larger than that, what's on the line. You know, I asked him about it. I said, what do you say to people, particularly Muslim Americans and young Democrats who feel enraged, infuriated by his handling of the war? And this was honestly the first time in this whole conversation when he didn't kind of poke back at me. And he said, I asked them for patience. For patience to let this process, meaning his attempts to try to wrangle some complicated diplomatic resolution here, that he hopes that that will ultimately demonstrate where his faith and his will lies. I don't think that's going to win him very many political points, frankly.
No, particularly since Bibi Netanyahu seems to pocket whatever gains he can get from the Biden administration and ignore the rest.
Bibi Netanyahu is an active supporter of the prospect of a Trump return to the presidency. I don't think there's any way in which Biden is banking very much on Bibi Netanyahu having an epiphany. I think the theory of the case is that what they're trying to do is create the prospect of a deal in which Israel receives normalization from Saudi Arabia and others, and that that creates such a popular prospect in the Israeli politics that that leads to an Israeli government willing to engage in that idea. And that government, it should be said, may not be led by Bibi Netanyahu, probably would not be.
Evan, we've had Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on this program, and I've talked with leaders of the No Labels group. What's the prospect in the end for a third-party candidate in 2024? Can any of them, any of the potential third-party candidates, have a consequential effect, and in which direction?
Historically, if you go back and look at the patterns all the way back to the Civil War, third parties tend to hurt the incumbent. And that's simply because they run on the basis of the fact that the current crowd can't get it done, so you need an outsider. In 2016, when people basically assumed that Trump was going to lose, third parties did very well. They got about 5% of the vote in the seven battleground states that matter. But in 2020, when people had this very acute sense that this election between Biden and Trump was razor thin, that third party vote plummeted. It went down to about 1.5% in those battleground states. So one of the things Democrats and the people who want Democrats to win are doing is focusing very much, and you're going to hear more about this, I suspect, in the months to come, on saying to people, it's fine if you want to vote for a third party, but you are in effect, in their view, voting for Donald Trump. I mean, the number of elements, David, that could conceivably throw an election like this against them is mind-boggling. When Houthi rebels started firing rockets at ships in the Red Sea, it had an immediate effect on global shipping to the point that it could have and could yet still push inflation back up. That could end up having a decisive effect on this election. This thing is a tie, David. It is a tie right now. It is a dead heat. And there will come a point later in this year when one of these factors, whether it's the thing Donald Trump says that adequately scares people into voting against him, or the thing that Joe Biden says that makes people scared about his age and capacity, not only today but in the future, that could have a decisive effect, or it could be one of these issues. I know this is the worst cliche in journalism, but this election has an element that is beyond anything we've ever really dealt with before. Because
But it seems pretty familiar, no?
Well, it's a rerun of the last election. The difference now is that Donald Trump is pretty explicit about why he's doing this, which is retribution. I mean, this is a man running very clearly to avenge what he lost, to prevent himself from going to prison, and to seek vengeance against the people who he thinks have done him wrong. I don't think we've had a condition like that before.
Do his voters understand it that way too?
I think his voters are, at this point, part of something that has almost nothing to do with ordinary politics, and it has to do fundamentally with identity and their sense of themselves. I mean, it is a movement, which is a really different thing than what Joe Biden is doing. Joe Biden is not running a movement. Joe Biden is running essentially a PowerPoint presentation to Democratic voters about the risks and benefits of how they vote. That's a different thing. Mm. Biden thinks that the Trump's constituency is not as big as we sometimes believe it is, meaning, yes, he has people who would do anything for him. But when it really came down to it in places like Iowa in the caucuses, it was the smallest turnout they've had in years.
So you see the South Carolina results, too, as not an overwhelming 20-point victory, but in fact, a one in which 40% of Republicans voted against Donald Trump, and that bodes poorly for Trump.
It's a pretty powerful fact because it does indicate that there are a lot of people out there who don't want to ever have to vote for Trump again. And what Biden has to do is make enough of a case to say, I know you have your problems with me, but we simply cannot bear that again.
Well, what is the agenda for a second Biden term, other than just to prevent Donald Trump from occupying the White House again?
One of the big things would be codifying Roe v. Wade, the idea that you could establish this through law, which, of course, in order to do so, would require a big political win. You would have to be able to get control of the House of Representatives. I think that's the right idea for them to be running on. That is the single most powerful argument against Republicans right now, is the rollback of a fundamental right in American life.
Well, let me read to you what Biden says at the end of your piece about Donald Trump and the election. Losers who are losers are never graceful. I just think he'll do anything to try to win. If and when I win, I think he'll contest it no matter what the result is.
And remind us, if we remember what happened the last time that he contested this, we had violence in the U.S. Capitol, and we've now had 4 years in which he has been draping himself in the language and the imagery of an anti-government resistance. This is not abstract, David. I think a lot of people didn't really have any reason to pay attention to where Donald Trump held his first big rally of the campaign. It was in Waco, Texas, on the anniversary, the 30th anniversary of the FBI raid on a cult that had been stockpiling weapons. It's a scene that is really a touchstone in the far right anti-government movement. And Donald Trump held his first campaign rally there, and they played the national anthem as sung by members of the insurrection on January 6th, who sang it into a phone in prison. This and on the screen behind them, they were playing images of his supporters storming this Capitol on January 6th. I mean, that in some ways is what Biden is getting at when he says that the press has become numb to it. The fact that we are not all talking about that and how truly dangerous that is.
But just to be clear, what you're suggesting is not just violence after November. You're suggesting that between now and November, there well could be violence in the streets on behalf of Trump, if not inspired by Trump.
Absolutely. Any fair analysis of the risks that the United States faces as a result of Trump's candidacy includes the very real prospect that the people who say that they would do anything for him and are well-armed will try to do something. Part of the task, I think, for Democrats is that the avalanche of information from Trump world is so extraordinary, and that so many of us are so sick of politics that we just tune it out, that Democrats have to figure out a way, and their technique is to do it slowly but steadily, of saying, this is not an optional election, my fellow Americans. This is a moment in which we are being told in Technicolor what this other candidate is going to do. And there will be a day when we can talk about who is next in line in this party and who will take over the future. But for the moment, Joe Biden has put himself in the position of running again, and that's your option. That's the message that Democrats will be forced to try to convey.
Evan Osnos, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Evan Osnos is reporting on President Biden's campaign. He's in the forthcoming issue of The New Yorker. He's a longtime staff writer, and he joins our podcast, The Political Scene, every Friday. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Over the last 30 years, tech companies, the upstarts of the business world back then, became the business world. Microsoft is rated the most profitable company on the planet by some rankings. Apple and Alphabet, which owns Google, are way up there as well. Tech companies have amassed incredible power. Their impacts on privacy, on mental health, on journalism, on just about everything, we're only beginning to understand it now. One of the sharpest voices on the evolution of the tech industry, and often one of the funniest, is the journalist Kara Swisher. She knows better than anyone how the internet came to define so much of our lives. And since the 90s, she's been influential and even feared in Silicon Valley, and she's just published Burn Book, a tech love story. It begins with Kara Swisher's time at the Washington Post, where we first met. I thought of you immediately some weeks ago when Tom Shales, mm-hmm. the legendary Washington Post TV critic, died.
Amazing guy.
And it's my memory. It is my memory from a million years ago in the Washington Post newsroom when I was a mm-hmm. child in the style section. Am I not crazy that you worked right
yes,
close to him?
I was there. Yes, I was. I sat right next to him. I mean, Shales had an office next to Mary Hadar. And so
the
it was this
editor.
Sort of
yeah.
style editor. And so, yeah, so Shales, I love Shales. What a guy. What a guy. What a guy.
Kara, I've been looking forward to this for weeks, and I have
Me too.
Tons of questions to ask you and about your book, which is so much fun and so interesting and the result of so many years of covering the tech mm-hmm. world. But I want to start out by asking you, how did you start to figure yourself out, what you wanted to be, who you wanted to be?
Well, one thing was I was gay, and I knew it from a young age. You know, a lot of people say it occurred to me at 21 when I started right. to have feelings about Martina Navratilova. it didn't. It didn't. I knew when I was four years old. I was wow. like, oh, I see. And I sought out a lot of information about it. And at the time, people don't remember this. I'm old. You're, I think, around my same age. It was not good to be gay.
Yeah.
It was not good. You had to hide it. It was furtive. And all the negativity it can build, the furtiveness particularly, mm. and the hiding and pretending and a performative behavior. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I just had a real hard time with it. And
when did it become an issue with other people, in a sense?
One issue was I really very much wanted to go to into the military. My dad was in the military, and I had a real interest in it and couldn't. It was, you know.
So you want, as I understand it, Carl, you want, either wanted to be in the military as an analyst or in the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
one
you
of
took,
those,
went
yeah.
the journalistic path instead, went to Columbia J School, I think.
Yeah, I did. I just, it was a different path. It was a similar thing. It was about analysis. And I had been super interested in scenario building. That was what really attracted me to intelligence work. It's like, if this, then that. If this, I was always, I loved a puzzle. And I loved a, if this happens, if you know certain information, you input it. And so it tracked with journalism. I wasn't a journalist in high school. It was college where I started at Georgetown. And I thought I could change people's minds in a way. A lot of things.
But
I
about
wrote.
What? In other words, we know you for years and years now about your connection to tech. Mm-hmm. When did that subject either land in your head or on your lap or something? How did
right.
that arise?
So I went to the Post, and I was the young person on the staff, like I was. And so they're like, young person, go out to AOL, visit them. And it wasn't at the time, it was more news about contractors, government contractors and assemblers mm-hmm. of computer systems, which, you know, CSI, there was, I forget the names of them all, but they all had acronyms in their names. But this was AOL, and nobody knew what to make of it. And I had gotten interested in it early on because I had a fellowship at Duke. And I had started to really use these devices. I was dating someone who lived in the former Soviet Union. We were using all kinds of weird internet protocols to communicate because it was phone calls were prohibitively expensive. So I was always drawn to this. And then I noticed it everywhere. And for example, remember the teletype machine at the
sure.
Washington Post that was at the entrance
sure.
right there on the fifth floor? I kept staring at it. I'm like, why are they have that? Why do they need that? It's all going to be in the computer. And I kept saying that to people. And they're like, Kara, move away from the teletype machine. And I was like, but it's an antique, don't you understand? And so I just got interested in it, and no one wanted to do it. That's really pretty much it. And once I got there and saw what AOL was doing, it fit in with my worldview about propaganda and about misinformation, but not just that, but about information, a global information system. And then I started to focus on the Post because when I saw Craigslist, I was like, oh, classifieds are screwed. And then when news was free, I was like, my own business is gonna get killed here. So what do we do here? And so that's where I got interested.
At a certain point, it seemed to me reading you mm-hmm. that your tone shifted. You became more skeptical of the big figures. In fact, mm-hmm. skeptical to the point of you can't stand some of them. You're brutally, brutally justifiably
yes.
critical of them in your book.
Yeah.
If it's possible to put your thumb on it,
mm-hmm.
what was the first example of when that penny dropped and you said, this is just, this is deeply problematic and nobody's seen it?
Yeah, I think, initially when one time, there were several different times, when Google tried to buy Yahoo and wanted 90-some percent of the search market, I'm sorry, that was a monopoly. I had covered the Microsoft trial for the Washington Post peripherally, and they were acting like, no, this is, we're nice. And I'm like, I don't think anyone should have 90. I don't care how nice you are. The next person might not be nice, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, huh. And then when Google again started copying books on their own and just doing it and recording live television, I was like, you don't have any respect for copyright. What do you, this thing costs money. What are you doing? It felt like shoplifting to me. And they were like, no, Kara. It's for the people. I'm like, well, the only people that seem to be doing well financially are you. Like, I don't know. It seems.
There seem to be almost a kind of, when we look back at the robber barons, or we look back at other tycoons in the past who are exploitative and awful, somehow this breed, they wore turtlenecks, they were young.
Not turtlenecks, just be clear. T-shirts and hoodies.
Hoodies.
But yes, they did. They sort of, I actually, one of the first stories I wrote at the Journal was about that ridiculous performative stuff. I did one on they only like tacos and, you know, they only go to burrito places, except it was all catered in, right? Or these titles that they had, Chief Yahoo or Chief Experience Officer. And I'm not the CEO. Well, the only one who did it, like, honestly, was I'm the CEO bitch, which was Mark Zuckerberg. I appreciated that, at least. I was like, okay, thank you. But a lot of them had this thing, and they'd be like, you know, I'm just like everyone else. I'm like, you seem to own most of the company, and you're in charge, but you want to pretend you're not in charge. So if it was a community, why don't we benefit? Why don't we get some of the money? That happened with AOL. There was an event where Steve Case said, we make $54 from each customer. I forget what it was, for each user. And I put my hand up. I'm like, oh, if we're making $54 off of me, where's my VIG? Where's my part? Where's my half of that? Because it's my information, right? And so a banker is not going to tell you, I'm here for you, Dave. I'm here because I want a community of money. Like, you'd laugh him out of the room, right? Like, anyway.
So let's jump in and talk about what seems to me a really pivotal moment in your book. December 2016, there's a meeting that the newly elected Donald Trump had with tech leaders, including Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. And you describe this as a major turning point on how you view the tech industry. Why is that?
That's correct. The first sentence of this book is, it was capitalism after all. These people had decried Trump to me privately over and over again. He's not going to win. He's a clown. He's not going to do what he says. And Musk said that too. Like, he's the only one who really did own up to it, like that he said it. And their need for money, and these were the richest people on the planet, right? And they walked into this meeting, which I scooped this story. Nobody knew they were going. Can you imagine meeting the president and not saying anything? Because they were embarrassed, and yet they wanted to get their repatriated income. They wanted to get their tax breaks. They wanted to get no regulation continuing. They wanted that to keep going on, that game to still go on. And I couldn't believe they went into the meeting as the most richest and most powerful people on the planet and didn't say anything about immigration, gay rights, that they had talked about caring about. And at least immigration, I thought they'd say something, because this guy was way out there on Muslims and on immigrants. He had called them rapists. And this was, like, two of the people in there were immigrants, Satya Nadella and Elon Musk. I was like, do you have nothing to say what you want from this person, given your enormous power collectively? You're like nation states. You have nothing to say. And they were so like, we know better, we'll handle it. And then I thought, no, you're just going to go in the special room and close the door on the rest of us. And the rest of us are going to pay the price for what happens here. And so that was enough. It had been building, but I shouldn't have been so naive, but I guess I was.
I'm talking with the journalist Kara Swisher, author of Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. We'll continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I've been speaking today with Kara Swisher, one of the most authoritative journalists on the tech industry to date. Swisher has just published Burn Book. That's not the Burn Book of Mean Girls fame, although the title is probably no coincidence at all. This Burn Book is subtitled A Tech Love Story. Swisher has become disenchanted, even enraged over the years, by the constant violations of users' privacy, monopolistic practices, and the way these companies have consistently ignored disinformation and mental health impacts. She eventually fell out with some of the leading tech people who had been her subjects and her sources. I'll continue my conversation with Kara Swisher. Let's talk about somebody who is a very vivid presence in your book. You write that in these early days, you used to always be able to count on Elon Musk to answer your phone calls and, quote, engage with me on a semi-human basis. When did that change? Because on October 17th of 22, he sent you an email with the subject line, "You're an asshole." What was he reacting to?
What happened with him is what I liked about Elon, and And one thing that's really interesting is I really did like, and people go, how dare you have liked him? I'm like, what do you want me to say? I did. Like, I'm not apologizing for that.
The New Yorker wrote a quite positive profile of him back when, about when he was mainly about electric cars.
Right. Okay. Electric cars, it wouldn't have been where it was without Elon Musk. Sorry, people. I know you hate him, but that's the facts. That's the facts. Mm-hmm. He really pushed it forward. Same thing with rockets. He changed the dynamic. I remember him calling me once so excited that he got a contract from the government because Lockheed and the rest of those people had it locked up. And I agreed with him. Good. Yay. Someone else is allowed in. And the stuff he was doing was innovative and lowering costs. I appreciate that, although I don't love the government completely stepping out and letting private companies run everything. I've never feel good about that. And at the time, as you recall, everyone else was building, and I use this example a lot, but like a digital dry cleaning service or, you know, a digital maid service or a digital, you know, kombucha delivery service. And when you get 400 calls like that, David, from these smart people, you're like, you literally want to like hit yourself with the cell phone on the head. Mm-hmm. You're like, I cannot listen to this crap anymore. And when someone comes with big ideas, you welcome them. And mm-hmm. I welcome that among Elon. I don't know what happened to him. I'm not his mama and I'm not a psychiatrist. But I think he, as he got richer and richer, there's always enablers around people that make them think they hung the moon. I think that can be very deleterious. Mm. Real wealth is mostly deleterious on people's psyche, unless you have a very strong psyche, right? And then during COVID, we had an interview, and he got very angry because I disagreed with him that COVID might affect more than zero people. And he went on and on about how much he knew. He read all the studies. I didn't read all the studies. He read. And I was like—
He did his own research.
Okay.
The phrase of the
right,
moment.
You know, and then he started to sound like those crazies online. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't think you know. I don't think any of us know. So, okay, sure, genius, you know. And it began to dawn on me. And then he became even worse. But then with Twitter, when he bought it, he and I had a long exchange, which I have in the book, about what to do about Twitter, because I love Twitter. So did he. He loved the product.
Do you still love Twitter?
No, I'm not on it at all. He and I had an exchange because I thought he could do a good job. It needed a jolt because its business model was terrible for its entire history. Its stock price stayed in the doldrums. It was a very slow-moving company, but still a terrific product at its heart. And then something happened. And I got to tell you, I don't know. In disagreement seemed, he never seemed bothered by disagreement, and then he was. But exceptionally so. Let me just tell you, this is what dawned on me. He loves video games. This guy loves video games, like you can't believe. He thinks he's Ready Player One. This is what Ben Mezrich pointed out to me, and I think he was correct. he thinks he's the main character in the video game, and the rest of us can be shot or done, or we don't exist. And it dovetails into his ideas around simulation. He thinks this is a simulation.
The whole world that
we live
in.
I don't know if you know that. Yeah. He's talked about it in an interview with me several times. He thinks this isn't real, except he's the main character. Oh, then it makes sense to you when you put that into it.
Wow.
You're like, oh, I see, he's the main character. So it doesn't matter what he says.
Unless I'm crazy, a politics has taken hold since 2016.
Oh, yeah.
And it's deepened.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of libertarian, right-wing, I can solve all problems. And it's rooted in something that I recognized years before this. You'd go into mm-hmm. a conversation with someone like Marc Andreessen, who is, by definition, intelligent as an investor.
He's brilliant.
Made, you know, God knows how much money he's an investor. But a lot of these guys, you meet with them, and they don't just know what they know. They know everything.
That's correct.
They know everything.
That is correct. Yeah,
you
he's
bring
a
up
particularly
climate
pernicious.
Change. Well, you put a garden hose up in the air and you spritz some, mm-hmm. and everybody else
yeah.
is stupid. That this is mm-hmm. psychology as well as an emerging politics. Talk about what that politics is in 2024 and who's got it.
It's literally people who are safe and rich and are unaffected and will be building that little castle in the sky that they're going to fly to when the rest of us are choking down here. And they know better. You're wrong. You've done it wrong. The media's done it wrong. The government's done it wrong. We know better. When they have lives full of mistakes, they just paper them over. They have such a cynical view of people. And ultimately, I don't think they like people. I think they find governing shabby. And then they pontificate of what we should do. And then not just that, they actually have influence, like with Elon and Crimea and things. They don't just pontificate, because that I can deal with. You're just a blowhard,
they have decisive
right?
influence. Somebody like Elon Musk in his system of satellites has been incredibly influential in the war in Ukraine.
Which, let me tell you, is an innovative and interesting thing he did. But should he be deciding what to geofence? I think not. But he can.
Right. So you point out in the book, Kara, that in the last 25 years of the internet age, our mm-hmm. government leaders have passed zero privacy protections. They haven't updated any trust laws or addressed its impact
nope.
on mental health,
nope.
especially in teenagers.
Privacy, no.
When it comes to regulating these companies, Facebook, mm-hmm. Amazon, Google, where should we start and where do you see any leadership coming from?
Well, let me put aside one. First of all, self-regulation is not going to work. It doesn't, like, let that airline self-regulate, let banks self-regulate.
Right.
We see where that's gone, right? And let me tell you, let's start with the premises. No regulation is going to work quite well enough. And the government falls down on the job a lot of times, but at least there's some semblance of guardrails on all those industries. When the door blew off the Alaska thing, there was so many investigations. People were fired. There's implications mm-hmm. for mistakes at Lockheed. At the government investigated. There's going to be fines. There's going to be lawsuits. Everybody gets to go around the thing for one door. One door. Two stories, one in the Washington Post, and this is not a new story, not the Washington Post, one in the Wall Street Journal, one in the New York Times, about the impact on young girls of internet, you know, and sexualization of young girls. Two stories. Are you kidding me? No, who gets fired? Who's getting fired here? Who's getting sued? This is like astonishing to me. And so—
What's the dynamic behind it? Why is there no regulation there? It's just sheer,
money?
Sheer amount of money. Mm-hmm.
Money is one thing, but it's not the only thing. It's one that the politicians, first, they were scared of it and didn't know what they were talking about. And that I get from any new industry. But now there's plenty of people who know stuff. Amy Klobuchar, Senator Warner, Senator Bennett, Mike Gallagher, who just left, I think is very smart about these issues. I don't agree with him on everything. Ken Buck was another person.
I was amazed, Kara. I was watching, quite frankly, I was watching the CEO of Condé Nast testify mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. AI. To a Senate subcommittee, mm-hmm. and a few other people were testifying. Mm-hmm. And Josh Hawley, who's very far mm-hmm. on
smart.
The right on most of these, was very smart about AI and the possibility of how this it could be terrible. So there are people, sometimes you'd watch committee meetings, and people had no idea how to turn on a phone or why, how Google made money.
Yeah.
It was pathetic.
That was Orrin Hatch.
Yeah.
That was the Orrin Hatch moment when he said, like, how do you make money? And they take advantage of that. And look, again, I'm not going to blame these companies. This is what capitalistic companies do, get every edge they can for their shareholders. This mm-hmm. is their charge. I think that they that the government has abrogated. Now, not all states have. You know, California's been very aggressive. Certain states have. And in the negative way, they've been aggressive, right? In Texas, some of these loony laws that they're trying to pass. And so into the breach of federal regulation has come all kinds of a patchwork of some good, some bad, and all very confusing. And confusion in confusion, these big companies get bigger. NVIDIA is now a $2 trillion company. Apple's a trillion, multi-trillion dollar company.
Microsoft. NVIDIA, which makes the chips that presumably is going to power AI.
That's correct. That's the latest one. Mm-hmm. And so these people are, these are nation states. Let's try to be clear. And they are affecting us. And they're, what's astonishing is, you know, when cars didn't have airbags or opiates were used, they got sued. You can't sue these people. You can't get them out of power.
Why not?
Section 230.
Explain.
A lot of these companies, if they, the early ones, if people posted on their things, they'd get sued by the person, and then they'd never, they would be die in the crib essentially because of lawsuits. That is absolutely true. Now it protects them from liability in a lot of instances where they shouldn't be protected. Now, listen, I'm not with the people that want to just get rid of it because that's also stupid. But there's we need to think about how we want to cover liability. We're doing it again. We're such an innovative country in terms of allowing innovation. The worries I have is that right now in generative AI, it's so expensive. It is. What do you think? Everyone was like, Sam Altman's raising $7 trillion for a new chip thing. I'm like, that's not enough, right? It's, you know, it's crazy, but it's expensive. So therefore, the only people that are going to dominate are the big companies, not the small ones. So where is the innovation going to come about if these giant companies control every bit of information? How are you going to fight copyright issues? David, you must be concerned with them ingesting all your content,
sure,
right? Condé Nast has got to be losing its mind over this. But do you have the firepower to fight them? Copyright laws are pretty good, by the way. You know, that's a good way to go at these people. But at some point it won't be because, you know, Barry Diller's fighting, the New York Times is fighting them. Because you know what they did last time. Well,
this is the second time, in a sense, this is the second time around.
It's worse because, David, they're not just going to links. They're not just controlling people getting to you, which is getting to your site. They're controlling they're going in and taking the content and vomiting it back up. That's theft. I don't know. That seems like theft to me on a very basic level.
So if you're sitting as the head of the New York Times or Condé Nast or the Washington Post, what would you ask for, demand, stamp your feet about from the tech companies where AI is concerned?
Pay me for my stuff. You can't walk into my store and take all my Snickers bars and say it's for fair use.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, get into legislation. Bother the senators and you have increasingly less power over time. They have increasing power. Get in there and say, they stole my stuff, sir, and I would like to be
again.
Paid, either get
By
paid
the way,
for
stole
it.
It again.
Stole it again. They didn't steal it the first time. Not quite.
Explain.
What they did is they didn't distribute it. They choked the means of distribution, and then they stole the advertising business. Now, fair and square, they stole it. And they took the – remember when everyone was taking Facebook money?
Remember,
they were giving you money? I don't know if you guys did.
Of course I remember.
They came to me. Sheryl Sandberg herself came to me and said, we want you to be part of this new thing. I go, you want my stuff for free? And she's like, yes, because then you'll get more distribution. And I go, you want my stuff for free? No. How about no?
There's a lovely moment toward the end of the book, and you write this. Mm-hmm. When I started covering the nascent sector in the 1990s, meaning tech, I had truly believed in tech's ability to transform the world, to solve problems that had plagued us for centuries, and allow us to finally see our commonality over all our differences. And so there's not just kind of tech futurism there. There's a sort of a sense of a new politics, of a world transformed. When did you lose that sense, if you have?
I have not. I'm a Trekkie. I said to my heart. Like, I use that analogy because Steve Jobs did, and I did too, is that there is a Star Trek version of the universe where we ultimately all get along, even despite the problems, and there's always problems. But often in Star Trek, if you notice, if you really pay attention, villains turn into good people.
They do.
But in Star Wars, that is not the mood of that you know,
it's sci-fi, intergalactic
science
battle.
Fiction.
Yeah,
it's an intergalactic battle, and evil wins a lot. And even at the end, That's not a it's not a victory. Victory is never assured. I do believe that technology can bring us together. It can make a better world. It can make better drugs. It can make us live longer and better.
Arguably, the worst problem we face is climate change.
Climate change.
Is technology going to have a magic wand for that?
Well, you know, I love when you said shoot a hose in the sky, because I've been in that meeting too, where they get like, we're going to shoot a... I'm open to all ideas, but it's an existential threat. And my fear is... Their plan is to, there's one, I'm not going to say who it is, but one of these guys told me their plan for ecological collapse, like the apocalypse is in. Their apocalypse plan, and they have them. You've written about them, and you wrote about them, right? Wasn't it you guys?
Evan Austin's written about, you know, you go off to New Zealand and you hide in the bunker. And
they had a motorcycle at their house, a speedy motorcycle that would get them to their place in Big Sur. And they told me where it was, you know, like that it's here and it's got a bunker, it goes down, it locks this, I've got this food, I've got this. Told me the whole, was fascinating. It was fascinating listening to it. I was like, interesting. And they had this, they had everything. They had a garden, they had the whole water, blah, 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 electricity, generator. And they said, what's your plan? And I said, my plan is to come to your house with a gun and shoot you and take your motorcycle. That's my plan. And invite all my friends. And they were like, and of course I could hear the click, click, click in their head, like, how am I going to stop this lesbian with a gun? What am I going to do? Because they're pretty good with guns, those lesbians. And you could hear it. And he was like, that was a contingency I hadn't thought of. Anyway, I'm not going to shoot him. I might. I don't know.
Karis, thank you so much.
This is great.
Karis Swisher's Burn Book is just out. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett.
And we had additional help this week from Jared Paul and Ramel Wood.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.